With his threats to ramp up the war on drugs, is Attorney General Jeff Sessions channeling the spirit of the guy who started us down this perilous path?
The war on drugs goes back much further than Richard Nixon, where most people think it originates, or with whom most people think it originates, and all paths lead back to Harry J. Anslinger, who was our first drug czar. I think of Jeff Sessions as the reanimation of Harry J. Anslinger. The language that they use is so similar, the worldview is so similar. The rejection of scientific knowledge and accumulated wisdom from a range of disciplines is similar. And so, in a way, to talk about Sessions is to talk about Anslinger.
That's Alexandra Chasson. We talk with her about her biography / cultural political critique of Harry J. Anslinger. It's called Assassin of Youth, a kaleidoscopic history of Harry J. Anslinger's war on drugs. Then we re-air our 2010 interview with cannabis legalization advocate Mason Tevert about his book, Marijuana is Safer. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The war on drugs is America's longest, and it's losing. But not only is it losing, but America is losing right along with it. The war on drugs has devastated communities of color, wasted billions of taxpayers' dollars, made neighborhoods more dangerous, shredded our constitutional rights, and promoted mass incarceration over treatment. Many have argued that the purpose of the war on drugs has less to do with public health than social control of minorities, immigrants, and poor people. It's a point of view Alexandra Chasson takes in her fascinating look at the man who laid the foundation of the war on drugs, Harry J. Anslinger, America's first drug czar. He linked drug use to immigrants and people of color, demonizing them as dangerous criminals, and promoted harsh drug penalties with a lock-'em-up mentality. He had a particular hatred for marijuana users. In her book, Assassin of Youth, Chasson examines what made Anslinger who he was and his social, cultural, and political legacy. Alexandra Chasson is professor of literary studies at the New School in New York and artistic director of Writing on It All, a public participatory writing project. Assassin of Youth is out from the University of Chicago Press. Alexandra Chasson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. Great to be here.
This is such an interesting book, Assassin of Youth, not only interesting because of the topic, but also because of the way that you have written it. As the subtitle says, it's a kaleidoscopic history of Harry J. Anslinger's war on drugs. I first want to ask you what got you interested in writing this book, and then why you decided to write it the way you did.
What got me interested in writing this book was I was teaching a course about the prison industrial complex in the United States, and to me the salient feature of prisons in the United States in the early 21st century is the disproportionate representation of young African American and Latino men, a great number of whom are doing time for nonviolent minor drug offenses. And so my question was, how did we get that situation? The answer is the war on drugs. And the war on drugs goes back much further than Richard Nixon, where most people think it originates, or with whom most people think it originates. And all paths lead back to Harry J. Anslinger, who was our first drug czar, the commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics from 1930, when the Bureau was established, until 1962. So for 32 years, right up the middle of the 20th century, it was Harry J. Anslinger making drug policy and endorsing certain kinds of drug legislation.
So while this book focuses on Harry J. Anslinger, you delve quite deeply into the background, into the context of this war on drugs. So I'd actually like to start there because you really track the origins of drug prohibition. In fact, you say, and I wrote down this paragraph because I just loved it, the sentence, "This is the story of the ingestion and transmission of values, the formation of mental habits, and the skill set and circumstances that made Harry a particular vehicle for drug prohibition." But those ingestion and transmission of values, he got from somewhere.
Well, yes, so that's the question. Once I see that we get the war on drugs that we do because of Harry J. Anslinger, the question becomes, how did Harry J. Anslinger become himself? How did he become the kind of commissioner drug czar that he was? And there are, of course, multiple answers to that, and most of them are cultural, things that circulated around him before he was born, even, and certainly then circulated around him more materially once he had been born as a child, growing up in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which I think of as very influential to his development as a bureaucrat, to the kind of alcohol education he would have encountered as a child, to the kinds of ordinances, local ordinances, and early pieces of legislation that were going to enable him to fight the drug war the way he did, of which he was completely unaware until he came into that office. His background in alcohol prohibition, which is a huge piece of cultural background for our war on drugs, which is formulated along the very same principles. So yes, there are many, many, many feeds into Harry J. Anslinger such that he becomes a drug prohibitionist, a bureaucrat, and a propagandist with a particular flair for sensationalist representations of the dangers of marijuana and for associating certain racial and immigrant social groups with particular drugs.
You go back into the early 19th century when we had the age of patent medicines, well, not early, even mid and late 19th century, the age of patent medicines, where people were peddling opium and other forms of, I mean, cocaine, I believe, as well, if I'm not mistaken. These were legal. They were part of what people took in. Give us the sense of that lay of the land, and then how did that change?
Well, I think for a good part of the 19th century, of course, opiates and cocaine did circulate, largely medicinally, and in particular the Civil War saw a huge surge in consumption, and following the Civil War, you saw a large population that was habituated to opiates, having been first treated for pain with opiates. Former soldiers often remained habituated, and so there were people who were understood to be what were called habitués, people who consumed narcotics regularly, but it did not have the kind of moral taint, for the most part, that it acquired in the 20th century. Not to say it wasn't sometimes a problem, but it just didn't have the kind of taint that it has now. And it wasn't I think in the 20th century, narcotic addiction became not only a moral pejorative, but it also became a kind of visible specter of the degradation of society in a certain way. I don't think that was true in the 19th century. You had people who were well-functioning. You had people who had perfectly good quality of life and took maintenance-level amounts of narcotics over long periods of time.
Yeah, and let's talk about class also, because in the very beginning, I was surprised to find out by reading your book, Alexandra Chasin, reading Assassin of Youth, that at first in the United States, drugs were recreation for the upper classes, and they were not at all seen as problematic.
Yes, I mean, I don't think there was a huge party scene, but absolutely, and there were little discoveries along the way of anesthetics, of gases, of certain kinds of drugs, and there were recreational applications of them. I don't think that that was, as I say, a really central public discourse. The discourse around alcohol was much more prominent. The social costs of alcohol, the individual moral failure associated with alcohol excess, the ramping up over the course of the second half of the 19th century of the temperance movement, culminating in the prohibition of alcohol. It's a lot more social focus on and talk about alcohol than narcotics.
Yeah, and the temperance movement was also, I mean, in some ways was seen as a progressive movement. I mean, women, it was the first great women's movement. A lot of working class men got paid in drink, as well as, you know, low wages, and were freely supplied with drink, which did destroy families. So I wonder if you could tease out kind of these swirling different strands of protest and prohibition and disapproval.
Yes, it will be very hard to sum up the temperance movement just because it covered so many decades. But as you say, it did have progressive roots and impulses in it. But it also became a kind of moral, I'm going to say, like, blunt instrument that I think by the end of alcohol prohibition, it was generally agreed that it was going to be impossible to legislate solutions to alcohol excess. And the cost of prohibition, and it was known in advance that there would be some of these costs, but the movement was strong. Part of the advantage of the decades of growth, it was a very grassroots movement, had very, very broad base support and really across the country. But it was known in advance that there would be a significant impact in terms of the loss of revenue, which is true of drug prohibition now as it was of alcohol prohibition then. The inducement to corruption was really significant because people made a lot more money selling bootleg liquor, just as they do now on illegal drug markets, than people made and currently make as law enforcement officials. Under prohibitionary scheme, there's no regulation of product. So you had then dangerous alcohol, just as you have now more dangerous drugs, drugs whose contents are hard to know and are potentially lethal. And also under alcohol prohibition, like under drug prohibition, the criminalization of the commodity and the activities surrounding the commodity impede public health frameworks. So it makes it harder to treat people who suffer from alcohol or drug addiction. So for all of these reasons, we knew by the early 1930s that prohibition was a disastrous strategy and a failing strategy. It did not suppress alcohol production, distribution, or consumption, just as drug prohibition also fails to reduce significantly, much less eliminate, drug traffic and drug consumption. So alcohol should have taught us the lesson that prohibition is a failed strategy, but I think that there are reasons that we didn't take that lesson.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Alexandra Chasson about her book, Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. So tell us what some of those reasons are.
Well, I think in the end that drug prohibition, and you have to ask this question because this is a program going on, you know, 70-plus years of existence, constantly failing to meet its own stated goals. What makes it so durable? What makes it so popular? And I think the answer is that it turns out to have what are perceived as beneficial social effects, namely a racist and classist kind of social control, level of disenfranchisement in African-American communities, level of economic disruption, social disruption is so significant by the way drug prohibition is enforced in this country. And I think that because there are enough parties that profit from the maintenance of that system, we experience the durability of this program. So I think alcohol prohibition was completely unsustainable, but I think that drug prohibition, which I think in a certain way took the baton, like we transferred the prohibition from alcohol to drugs. Drug prohibition ramped up exactly at the time that alcohol prohibition was on the way out. And I think in the course of the long ramping up of the war on drugs, the patterns of enforcement have turned out to perform, as I say, this perceived as beneficial social effect.
Yeah, and you know, I do want to get to the subject of your book, who is Harry J. Anslinger, but just to go down this road a little bit further, you talk about racism, the use of this. I mean, this is very early that drugs started to be associated with, you know, criminality. But lately, the opioid epidemic has exploded in the United States, has been affecting white populations at least as much, if not more, than communities of color. And the conversation started to change. So that's one point. It started to change. I'd like you to comment on that and then comment on the indications that Jeff Sessions seems to be dragging it back to where it was before. So I wonder if you could comment on these developments.
Yes, I'd be happy to. I think of Jeff Sessions as the reanimation of Harry J. Anslinger. The language that they use is so similar. The worldview is so similar. The rejection of scientific knowledge and accumulated wisdom from a range of disciplines is similar. And so in a way, to talk about Sessions is to talk about Anslinger. Sessions, who is otherwise a proponent of states' rights, of course, went on record saying he would not agree not to enforce federal law, which differs from state law in those states where marijuana, for example, has been decriminalized. And so this is a card he still holds. I would have said before the election that if California voted yes on Prop 64, which was to legalize marijuana, that would be tantamount to federal legalization. California did vote yes on Prop 64, but the same night Trump was elected, and then he appointed Sessions. And so I no longer think that the passage of Prop 64 is immediately tantamount to federal legalization, but I do think it's inevitable. I think Sessions is going to slow it down, and I think he's going to make the usual suspects pay. So I do think you're looking at potential resurgence of the kinds of enforcement practices that have created the disproportionate representation of African American and Latino men in prisons. So that's the marijuana story. The question of the opioid epidemic is a different one and, of course, has different racial overtones, as you suggested. So maybe we're looking at a situation where, because white people are perceived as central actors and at risk, you're going to see a more robust public health response. I guess that would be good, because certainly there's a need of a public health response. It would be better if we had racial justice in both our criminal justice systems and our public health systems.
Of course, if they cut $800 billion out of Medicaid, it's going to be extremely difficult to tackle the opioid epidemic. In fact, if they destroy the healthcare insurance system that we have now, much less not improve it, that's going to happen also. But let's go to Anslinger. Now, tell us a little bit about Harry Anslinger and the context within which he grew up and what led to him becoming such a prohibitionist.
So he was born in 1892 in Altoona, Pennsylvania, which was the headquarters of the machine shops of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company. So it was a company town, and most boys and men in the town worked for the railroad, as did Harry's father and some of his brothers. And Harry himself worked his way up through the company, and his final job was as a detective working on behalf of the company. And he went from there to government work in Harrisburg briefly, then down to Washington, where he also worked very briefly, and then set out with a diplomatic legion to Europe. Tail end of World War I, he stays on after the war, works in northern Germany doing import-export work, and is then sent to the tropics, to his horror. Does a little time in Venezuela, a little time in the Bahamas, doing prohibition work there, and distinguishes himself by getting France and England to sign certain forms or to agree that boats going in and out of the Bahamas should be signing certain forms about their destination. And so it's really a bureaucratic little triumph, but it brings him to the attention of officials in Washington, and shortly thereafter he's installed as the first commissioner of the new Federal Bureau of Narcotics. And my contention is that his work with the railroad company was really significant because the Pennsylvania Railroad Company was the largest corporation in the United States at the time, 40,000 employees, huge number of departments and sub-departments and divisions and subdivisions and rules and regulations. And I think that Harry learned the lessons of the ascendant large corporation and then brought them with him to government service, and so that he was part, not by any means alone, but part of a wave of people elaborating government bureaucracy. So I think he trained as a bureaucrat in the corporation, and then when he became the drug prohibitionist that he became, it was because his background was in prohibition. He knew nothing about drugs, and he continued to know nothing about drugs for the time that he worked in office, but he was an expert in bureaucracy and in prohibition, and those expertises were really all he needed, it turned out, to establish drug, and he didn't really establish it, to consolidate, I'll say, drug prohibition in the United States.
And we're talking with Alexandra Chasson about her book, Assassin of Youth. It's about the history of Harry J. Anslinger's war on drugs.
You actually connect Taylorism, when you talk about the development of the corporation, what I get a picture of is, first of all, the development of the hierarchy in the large corporation, the control over time, which is Taylorism, productivity.
Yep.
I wonder if you could tie these in and show us, connect the dots to prohibition.
Well, I think that I hesitate to say this only because I'm afraid I'm about to sound like Steve Bannon, but I think that what's at stake in both of those domains is administration. That is, that what the corporation is better and better at doing as it becomes more elaborate, more and more minutely time-bound and rule-bound, is that it becomes better at administrating. And when government bureaucracy is elaborated, it also becomes better at administrating populations, right? And so in the nature of prohibition is the imagination or the idea that it's possible to control a field, right, to control a field of production, distribution, and consumption. It's a suppressive methodology or strategy, prohibition is. And so it requires, the whole idea of it requires really tight administration. So that, I think, is one of the connections between that kind of corporate bureaucratic outlook and prohibition in particular.
And is there also a sense in which drugs are seen as something that can't be controlled, especially, say, drugs like marijuana or the other, you know, psychedelics, for example? You know, the whole antipathy towards them is an antipathy towards a kind of uncontrolled freedom of the human mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the reasons that I use the word phobia to describe Harry's outlook. I think of him as suffering from tropics phobia. He certainly had xenophobia. And I think that his racism was at base phobic or kind of hysterical as well. I think in his mind, and I don't think he's the only one, drugs are something that creeps across borders. Drugs are something that they're like contaminants. They're like a medium that can't be stopped at the border, that infiltrates the social body, the body politic, that comes from other places, namely other countries across borders, or that emanates out from inner cities, which I think he also imagined as a kind of multicultural cauldron of social pathology. So yes, I mean, they spread in this uncontrollable way, and then once they get in the individual body, yes, they are disinhibitors, right? So I think what you're saying is really resonates on both those levels.
And doesn't this enter into the dichotomy or the different treatment between medical versus recreational use of drugs?
Well, yeah, right. One is very closely administered, right? And the other takes place in an unregulated zone, a zone with no oversight, for sure.
So we have barely touched the surface of your wonderful book, Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. I'd like to ask you to talk about the construction of this book, the kaleidoscope of it, the discursiveness of it.
So, yeah, a few points on that. One thing that I wanted by a kaleidoscopic approach was to emphasize the need for an interdisciplinary approach to understanding the war on drugs. You can read legislation history, you can read history of law, but it's very hard to get a sense of how that policy and law emerges and plays out against a wider cultural and social backdrop. And so by kaleidoscope, part of what I mean is we got to throw a lot of different parts of the culture in there to understand this better, because if we look at it through a single lens, we're still not seeing what we need to see that's going to enable us to think very differently about how we deal with drugs in this country. So interdisciplinarity is one of the things I meant by kaleidoscopic. Another is a visual aspect. The book is composed of many small chapters, each of which is built around or follows from a primary historical document that is pictured in the book. So the book has tons of pictures of, and again, a wide range of different kinds of images and documents, whether they're land deeds or a photograph of the Coast Guard busting a rum runner. There's a huge range. And so it's partly, again, the range that I wanted to show, but also the visuals are, I think, a really fun way of springboarding into some of the history. And then finally, I wanted to write in a way that was a little bit less straightforward than the typical biography or history, because I felt that some of that straightforward approach is too close to the kind of logic that is compatible with Harry's own way of thinking. And so whereas Harry was a huge proponent of these features of a prohibitionist strategy, and we still have these today, harsh sentencing, compound penalties for repeat offenders, and mandatory minimum sentencing. And the amount of damage that has been done by mandatory minimum sentencing is so extreme that I didn't want to write mandatory minimum sentences in a book that asks us to reexamine the origins of the drug war. And so my sentences tend toward a kind of lyrical excess, tend to play with words and with sound, and tend, while I hope conveying a whole bunch of information about the war on drugs, to resist the kind of straight line logic that produces Harry and, in turn, drug prohibition.
Well, it is a fascinating book. It is Assassin of Youth, A Kaleidoscopic History of Harry J. Anslinger's War on Drugs. And Alexandra Chasen, thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much. It's been a great talk.
Alexandra Chassin teaches literary studies at the New School in New York. She's authored several previous books, including Selling Out, The Gay and Lesbian Movement Goes to Market, and two works of fiction. Assassin of Youth is out from the University of Chicago Press. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we re-air our 2010 interview with marijuana legalization advocate Mason Tvert. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're taking a close look at drug prohibition policy in the U.S. today. 26 states and the District of Columbia currently have laws broadly legalizing marijuana in some form. Three other states may soon join them after recently passing measures permitting use of medical marijuana. Three other states will soon join them after recently passing measures permitting use of medical marijuana. A number of states have also decriminalized the possession of small amounts of marijuana. But Attorney General Jeff Sessions seems poised to reverse the trend. He's threatening to ramp up the war on drugs and strongly enforce federal penalties against marijuana. Back in 2010, I spoke with Mason Tvert, a longtime warrior in the trenches of the marijuana legalization movement. At that time, you could count the number of states that had decriminalized both medical and recreational marijuana on the fingers of one hand. Now, as the Trump regime threatens to send us back to prohibition, I thought it would be good to air my interview with Tvert once again. He's co-founder and executive director of Safer Alternative for Enjoyable Recreation, or SAFER, and the Safer Voter Education Fund. His book, co-written with Steve Fox and Paul Armentano, is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? It was updated and reissued by Chelsea Green Publishing in 2013. Mason Tvert, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
The foreword to your book is written by the former chief of police of Seattle, Norm Stamper. Why would a chief of police be in favor of the legalization of marijuana?
Well, he's been in the front lines of the war on drugs, and he knows better than anyone that marijuana is really not a problem. It does not contribute to the serious problems that we see, like domestic violence or fighting or sexual assault or other violent crimes. It does not contribute to serious health or social problems. And yet, alcohol, a substance that we certainly welcome with open arms in the society, does contribute to those problems. So, as he points out in the foreword, every police officer in the country knows that alcohol is far more dangerous than marijuana and contributes to far more problems, and he thinks it's time we recognize that fact.
You give a couple of examples in your book of what you're talking about in terms of marijuana versus alcohol. You start the book talking about a soccer match in Lisbon, Portugal. Tell us what happened there.
Well, this was a case where it was a soccer match that people expected could result in a lot of violence and fighting, hooliganism, and so on. And police in that city said they made it very clear to everyone who was attending the match that if you use marijuana, we're going to look the other way because we would rather you use marijuana instead of drinking. Alcohol is going to be the focus of our efforts. And, of course, as a result, many people did decide to use marijuana, and the game went off without a hitch. There were no serious problems, and it wasn't really until later that night when people were able to go to the bars and get drunk that we started to see a whole lot of problems in that city. But they really demonstrated that when people are given a choice and some use marijuana, far less drinking is going to take place.
You also bring up the case of U.S. Olympic swimming champion Michael Phelps. Tell us about what happened to him.
Well, Michael Phelps is without a doubt one of the best athletes in the world today, and he was recently in the news this past year when he was at a party in South Carolina where a photo of him was taken smoking some marijuana out of a bong, and it sparked this huge uproar in the media, and he was suspended from his team, he was forced to apologize, he almost lost he did lose a particular sponsorship deal with Kellogg's, but it was really a huge to-do over the fact that this young man, who's within the age that most Americans try using marijuana, simply did. And although there were reports that he had been drinking heavily and acting obnoxiously, no one seemed to mind that. But the second he decided to use some marijuana, all of a sudden it was a big deal. And he was shamed into apologizing and so on and punished. And it sent this message that, you know, if you drink or use alcohol, you're going to be okay. But if you use marijuana, you're going to be ridiculed and punished. And it sends a very dangerous message to not just other athletes, but to young people and all people. So we, you know, in light of the fact that the USA swimming team is sponsored by Anheuser-Busch, it's really quite hypocritical, and it's dangerous.
So here you are, you're drawing the contrast between drinking and smoking pot. Your book is Marijuana is Safer, and the subtitle is, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? What do you mean by driving people to drink?
Well, although we do contrast marijuana use and drinking because marijuana is safer, we also do highlight the fact that millions of people use marijuana for the same reasons that they drink. People use marijuana to celebrate. They use it to enhance experiences or as a social lubricant. And really what it comes down to is, you know, these are two interchangeable substances that people use to have a good time. And when we prohibit marijuana yet fully accept alcohol and even threaten people with punishment for using marijuana but promote alcohol use, we're sending this message that says that it's, you know, okay to drink, and in doing so, we're driving people towards drinking. We're threatening them with punishment if they make the choice to use marijuana. We're threatening them with drug tests that only come up, really, with marijuana. They don't actually test for many other things because marijuana stays in your system far longer. So overall, we are seeing an inflated number of alcohol users, an artificially inflated number of alcohol users, and an artificially deflated number of marijuana users as a result of our laws.
Hmm. Lay out the case for us first here. Give us a compare and contrast. Why do you say that marijuana is safer than alcohol? We know that alcohol is bad for you, but why do you say marijuana is safer?
Well, you've just made a very important point right there, is that we do, as a society, know alcohol is harmful, but we do also accept the fact that people like to use it and that it should be legal and that it's okay if people want to get a little intoxicated. So understanding that is really important, that our society does accept the use of a substance like alcohol. That said, marijuana is by every objective standard far safer, and every objective study has concluded that it's less toxic, it's less addictive, it's less harmful to the body, whereas alcohol contributes to 35,000 American deaths every year, and that's not including DUI. We're talking solely about use, so cancer and overdose deaths and cirrhosis of the liver. There's not a single death attributed to marijuana use in this country or any country, and there's never been a marijuana overdose death in history. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, alcohol is far more addictive than marijuana. And, of course, when it comes to the social consequences, alcohol has been closely linked with violent crime and fighting and domestic violence and sexual assault and injuries, whereas marijuana has never been found to contribute to these very serious problems. In fact, it's often found to inhibit that type of behavior. So we really have to ask ourselves, why on earth would our government prefer we use a more dangerous substance than we might otherwise prefer to use?
It inhibits that kind of behavior? What do you mean? Why?
The effect that marijuana tends to have on people is that it makes them calmer, less likely to take risks, they're risk averse, they're less likely to become aggressive or violent. So ultimately what we see is people who are less likely to engage in risk-taking or violent activity than they might otherwise be. So it, you know, actually inhibits that form of behavior that alcohol tends to make more likely. We see alcohol making people, you know, we call it liquid courage. It makes people take chances, take risks, think they're invincible. And it also makes, you know, for anyone who's been in a crowded bar or a college party, they know that it makes people aggressive and they tend to get a little rowdy and out of control.
Yeah, you say marijuana is less harmful, less addictive. That's still opening the question as to marijuana being harmful and addictive. I mean, for example, if you're driving and you're high, you could, I would say that your functioning is pretty impaired.
That's why I prefaced this by saying, listen, we as a society allow the use of alcohol. We accept that people enjoy using it and that there are some harms. Now, with marijuana, it's far less harmful and far less of a problem, but yet for some reason we don't accept it. And maybe if we did allow people to use marijuana, we'd see fewer people drinking and causing the problems associated with that. We make it very clear in the book that marijuana may not be for everyone. We never call it harmless. We certainly highlight the fact that it could contribute to problems with minors and young people and with driving. But the fact is that driving under the influence of marijuana is currently illegal. It would remain illegal if marijuana remained legal. And it would remain illegal for young people. In fact, changing our laws might actually make marijuana less available for younger people. Very likely.
How would that be?
Well, right now, young people have better access to marijuana than older people, and it's considered by our government to be, quote, universally available to them. And this is very much the result of prohibition. By keeping marijuana in a black market, young people are able to access that market, and there's no one asking for ID or anything. And what we end up seeing is young people able to get marijuana easier than they're able to access alcohol, which is currently the case, according to the government. So why on earth, if marijuana is a problem, wouldn't we want to control it better? But the fact remains that it's not really much of a problem. There really are not a lot of negative consequences, if any, associated with adults using marijuana responsibly.
We're talking with Mason Tvert about the book he co-authored, Marijuana is Safer. So you're saying if it were legalized the way alcohol is, that it would the distribution of marijuana would be more controlled, and just like every time I go to the grocery store, and I who am many decades away from the age of 21, I have to show my ID every time I buy a bottle of wine. You're saying it would actually make it more difficult for young people to obtain marijuana. And yet marijuana, underage minors have an awful easy time obtaining alcohol if they want to, and that's controlled.
Well, they have a harder time of obtaining alcohol than they do marijuana. And, you know, it's really a sign of a failed policy when our goal with marijuana prohibition is to protect young people from marijuana. But the overall effect is that young people have the best access to it, and old people are not able to access it. And if they want it, they need to go to young people to get it. You know, another issue here is that we're able to control the product. We're able to control what other products are available in that market. For example, if someone is going into a liquor store, they're only going to find liquor. But if someone is purchasing marijuana from some black market source, whatever it might be, it's possible there's going to be other illegal products available, and they're going to then have that access to the black market and other dangerous drugs. So why not take marijuana, which more people want to use than any other illegal drug in the world, and regulate it, put it in a store where they aren't going to find other illegal products, make sure the quality is good. Make sure that only people who are supposed to be getting it are getting it, and have strict penalties against those people who break the rules, much like with alcohol.
We're speaking with Mason Tvert. His book is Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? You have a co-author, too, don't you?
There's a couple. Steve Fox, who is the director of State Initiatives at the Marijuana Policy Project, and Paul Armentano, who is a deputy director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
We've been hearing a lot about the supposed increased potency of marijuana, that, in other words, this isn't your parents' marijuana. This isn't the same stuff that was around in the 1960s and 70s. Could you address that?
Sure. Well, number one, it's really important to know that regardless of how potent marijuana is, it's absolutely non-toxic, non-lethal, and cannot contribute to an overdose death or other serious injuries simply by using it. That said, this notion that today's marijuana is more potent than yesterday's or that from 25 years ago is generally a myth. What we see is 95% of marijuana samples that are confiscated by police tend to be right about the same as they were 25 years ago. The most potent marijuana today is found to be more potent than it was the most potent marijuana a while back. But again, it's important to point out that, number one, this doesn't have any negative effect on the user. In fact, it somewhat has a positive effect because it means the user is going to use less of it. And it also, what we do find is that many times most marijuana users prefer less potent marijuana. Just like with alcohol, there's, you know, everything from beer to wine to liquor to grain alcohol. A lot of people just prefer drinking beer or wine. With marijuana, it's no different. Even though that hard liquor is out there, a lot of people would rather just use the less potent stuff. But even if they do use the harder, more potent marijuana, there's not any serious consequence associated with it like there is with hard alcohol.
Do you think that people might want to take some of your statements with a bit of caution, just in the sense that people, there are genetic differences. People may have different reactions.
Absolutely. We actually have a section of the book that's titled, Is Marijuana for Everyone? And the answer is absolutely not. For young people, for teenagers, kids, people with developing brains, there's still a lot we don't know about marijuana, and we certainly don't think people should be using it. And then, of course, when it comes to people who might have, mental health issues or other serious problems where marijuana might become a problem for them, of course it makes sense for them to take caution. But the point here is that, you know, there's no reason for us to be making criminals out of the many millions of people who do enjoy using marijuana and do find that it's a safer alternative to alcohol. You know, we should be providing evidence-based drug education, getting people this information about the harms of these two substances, and letting them make the choice that is really going to benefit them in the long run. Obviously, alcohol is an incredibly addictive substance. Marijuana can be considered addictive. It's not found to have any physical withdrawal symptoms or any other serious addiction indicators. However, if you do anything far too much, you can experience problems with your life. Obviously, if you're doing nothing but using marijuana all day, you're probably not going to have a very good relationship with a spouse or other loved ones. You're probably not going to excel in your job or in school. So doing anything far too much is going to be problematic, and people should recognize that. Eating too much, having sex too much, there's all sorts of things people do have a negative implication on their life, but that doesn't mean we need to make them illegal. It means we just need to provide people with the information that they need to make good decisions when it comes to these types of things.
So you're saying just kind of the way sex can be addictive, well, we're not going to make sex illegal. You wouldn't want to make marijuana illegal.
That's absolutely right. And I would say even more so the way that we find that people, millions and millions of people become alcoholics, that doesn't mean we need to have an outright prohibition of alcohol. We need to tell people about the harms of the substance and also how to take caution and then have ways of treating people with these substance abuse issues, but we should not be criminalizing people who might have a substance abuse problem, and we certainly shouldn't be criminalizing people who don't have problems with these substances but simply enjoy using them.
We're talking with May St. Vert. The book he co-authored is Marijuana is Safer. So with all of this, I mean, in your book, Marijuana is Safer, you also point out non-medical, non-ingesting uses of marijuana, that is the use of hemp for biofuel, for clothing, for a whole range of things that could help, for example, you know, create safe biofuels rather than corn ethanol, which seems to have more problems than it's worth. So why is marijuana illegal? What's behind the prohibition? You say you should follow the money. What do you mean?
Well, there's long been speculation that when it comes to marijuana's industrial uses, it tends to be a competitor for a lot of other products. But also, alcohol, now that it's legal, has developed a massive lobbying apparatus that gives millions and millions of dollars to local, state, and federal campaigns, and really has carved this niche into our society by sponsoring so many major sporting events, major sports teams, again, giving donations to elected officials, and really making alcohol part of our society. And we are not going to see nearly the backlash to the harms associated with alcohol that we do with marijuana as a result. When it comes to marijuana, however, people have been scared with a misinformation campaign of propaganda that's been going on for 70-plus years. They've been made to fear marijuana for one reason or another, whether they were told it's a gateway drug or whether they were told it will make people, you know, go crazy, or whether they were told it will make, you know, black men rape white women. I mean, all these ridiculous things for so long have created this perception of harm in people that it just has resulted in them not thinking it's worth making it legal. And that's what we're trying to address.
So you're saying it's because the alcohol industry is so big and they've been able to kind of muscle legislation to keep the heat up on marijuana?
It's not so much that they are keeping the heat up on marijuana. It's just that they've managed to make alcohol such a major part of our society. The fact that we have beer ads every other commercial on TV, and we have billboards all over, despite evidence that these types of marketing campaigns do make young people want to drink more, they've gotten away with that. We find that they, you know, can give millions of dollars to candidates, so there are political candidates who are accepting money that is from a liquor company who, you know, who knows how much destruction was caused by the product that was sold. But then those political candidates turn around and say, well, God forbid we allow people to use marijuana because it's illegal and so bad, when in fact it is safer than alcohol. So as a result of all that, they've really managed to monopolize the intoxicant industry here in the United States and abroad.
But it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, you know, the alcohol industry could do very well, thank you, I'm sure, if marijuana were legalized. So why do you think there has been such a tenacious criminalization of marijuana?
Well, like I said, there's been a campaign that's been waged since the 1930s, if not even before that in some places.
But why? Why that campaign?
For a variety of reasons, whether it's moral reasons. I mean, one of the first anti-marijuana crusaders, the first government officials who pioneered the movement against marijuana was a moralist, an evangelical. He thought it was wrong for people to use marijuana. We saw William Randolph Hearst, the publisher who used his newspapers to spread misinformation about marijuana. He was in the publishing industry, and he owned timberland in Mexico. And when that land was taken over by Mexican revolutionaries, he was upset. And so he used his newspapers to spread these, you know, sensationalistic yellow journalist stories about the crazed Mexican who's hopped up on marijuana and killing white people. We saw all those types of things. Now we've seen people who are, you know, these days who are just against marijuana because it's illegal. They don't even know what's wrong with it, but because it's illegal, they think it should remain illegal.
In fact, am I wrong, or do I remember that in your book you make a suggestion that it is even partly the very qualities of marijuana that are kind of peace-inducing, you know, that it's pretty hard to, if you're high on marijuana, to get into any kind of real fight, that there's something about the nature of marijuana itself that contributes to its criminalization in the society?
That's a very good point, and that's really part of what resulted in the anti-marijuana movement in this country really exploding in the late 60s with Richard Nixon. Obviously, the Vietnam War was going on. Nixon was president. And he really noticed, and his administration noticed, that everyone who was against the war, the young people, the radicals, the so-called hippies and so on, the liberals, and then certain groups that he disliked, it's very well known he disliked Jews and blacks and other minorities, all of those people had one thing in common, and it was marijuana. They either used it or associated with people who used it, and he quickly recognized that one way to control those who opposed his agenda or those who he disagreed with was through marijuana laws, and that's when we really saw a huge pickup in the amount of enforcement taking place with regards to marijuana in this country. So there's no doubt that the fact that marijuana appealed to a certain type of person resulted in people fighting it harder.
Tvert makes a case for the economic benefits of legalization, especially for cash-strapped state budgets. I asked him why some states, like Michigan and California, might be turning to marijuana as a source of revenue.
Marijuana is projected to be a $113 billion industry, and that's a conservative estimate. By making marijuana legal, not only will we see revenue generated by excise taxes and so on, and of course we'll see savings with regards to the criminal justice system and so on, but we'll also be creating so many jobs. I mean, think about the alcohol industry. It's not just the people who make it and the people who happen to sell it. It's the hostesses and the bartender and the waitress and the owner of the bar and the person who does their marketing and the truck driver that brings the product to the bar. And, you know, think about all the venues at which alcohol is sold and every person who works as a beer vendor at a ball game or at a concert. I mean, there's just millions of jobs out there that people could have, but we don't let them have. So all those people, if they were able to have jobs, would be paying income taxes and paying state and local taxes. So we would just see a huge boon to our economy by simply making this a regulated product, much like with alcohol. And of course, then there's also the industrial uses of marijuana, which you mentioned earlier, with regards to industrial hemp products and so on. Right now, hemp is quite a popular thing. It's a very useful product, but it's not being grown in this country because it's illegal, yet it is legal to import it from other countries. So all these other countries are making money producing hemp products and selling them in the United States when this could be a crop that people in middle America and Kansas and particularly in the eastern plains in Colorado could be harvesting and benefiting from.
And that was Mason Tvert, co-author of Marijuana is Safer, So Why Are We Driving People to Drink? We have links to excerpts at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.